welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is Daniel S. Markey, Senior Research Professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Daniel, thanks for coming on the show.
It's great to be with you, John.
You published a book last year called China's Western Horizon, looking at Chinese foreign policy across the Eurasian continent. It's a very informative analysis, especially in the way that you illuminate specific local dynamics in regions where China's influence is increasing. But just to start us out, in the broadest terms, how would you describe China's global aspirations? What does Beijing want, and how is it trying to get it?
Well, it's a great question, and thanks for referring to the book. Look, I think there's a lot of debate about what China is up to in the world. And to simplify things, I would just say that we know one thing for sure. China is doing more and seems to be significantly more ambitious in its agenda for interacting both with its neighbors and internationally than it was 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago. And if we look at the likely trajectory, this seems to be holding steady. And if we look ahead, we can anticipate more of the same. So what does China want to do with its power? Well, I think that's a debate, and with its power and its influence, but that's a debate that's happening both inside of China and externally as well. And you know, we can take this conversation in lots of different directions, but I think we still have a lot of unanswered questions about, you know, does China want to remake the world in its image? Does China want to remake its neighbors politically or economically in its image? Does China want to control or dominate its region to the exclusion of other powers? I'd say we have more questions than answers still in a lot of these areas. But one thing is for sure, as I go back to the beginning, China's got more power and resources and capacity for influence than it ever has, certainly in anyone's lifetime. And we can expect that that's going to change things nearby and farther afield.
To what extent does achieving a respected status as a leading great power animate Beijing's policies? And conversely, to what extent do you think America's approach to China has become a harder line out of fear that China is challenging America's position atop the global pecking order?
I talk about this a bit in the book, and I think, you know, I'm quite a lot more comfortable observing the ins and outs of how America is responding to China, in part because of China's own opaque system. It is difficult to really be certain, and anyone who suggests they are certain about what motivates China is either overreaching a bit in their understanding of what's going on there, or there's certainly a degree of speculation. But what I can say is that certainly Americans are uncomfortable with the notion of being pushed out from the number one place in the international system, and even uncomfortable with the notion of being pushed out of the number one place in the Asia Pacific, or now the Indo-Pacific. And China threatens to do that in just simply because of its scale, its capacity, at first economically, but increasingly politically and militarily as well. And so, I think what we've seen throughout history is that powers, world powers, rise often economically first, followed by military and political power. And as they rise, their ambitions are shaped in part by how they rise and the conditions of their rise. And so I think China is in the midst of that for fairly well along, and increasingly seems ambitious in its dealings, certainly with the United States and with its nearby neighbors. And, you know, in the book, I talk a bit about a shift that I've observed from this hiding and biding pattern of China's relations with the world to one of striving for achievement. So one of sort of hiding its capabilities, biding its time, expecting that good things will come to China who waits, and now increasingly kind of stressing its capabilities, flexing its muscles, demonstrating its leadership in a variety of ways that really have only emerged, I think, for sure, over the past decade.
What does achieving or possessing a high status mean in terms of the real world? Is it just about perceptions? And even perhaps more, is it just about self-perceptions? Or does it manifest in ways that actually matter for power and influence?
Oh, it's certainly both in my own view. There is a domestically oriented element. You know, when the United States or when America's leaders speak about our position as a superpower, part of that is pitched to an American audience who expects to hear that America is in the number one position in the world. For China as well, there is increasingly an audience for a nationalistic, increasingly sort of bellicose, even at times, definitely aggressive. We describe it as wolf warrior diplomacy, an appeal to China's greatness in its own terms that appeals to Chinese. But I also think that perception of power outside of China shapes the behavior of other states. And as they look to China increasingly as an alternative to American power or to whatever the regionally dominant player has been in the case of Central Asia, as they look to China maybe increasingly and less so to Russia, the perception of power, the perception of status does shape how they frame their own policies, where they look to for support or for opportunities, for patronage, for additional resources, for protection, for influence globally. So yeah, it's not just a matter of looking inward and pitching to a domestic audience, but it's also a matter of looking outward. And one of the interesting questions as we think about China is who their most important audiences are as they pitch a more nationalistic message to the world. It doesn't seem to go over terribly well, you know, with an American audience or even with a European audience. Definitely seems to go over better with a Chinese audience. And then there are other questions about how for contested parts of the world or for the developing world, how this message actually comes through. And I think there it's a mixed story. It's a case by case. But I think that China wants to demonstrate through its own words and actions that it is arriving, it has arrived in some ways, and that is shaping the behavior and response of other powers in the world.
Let's look at the Middle East. After decades of costly entanglement in that region, for the United States, there's an ongoing debate about whether we should draw down from that region and shift our focus and resources either back here at home or elsewhere for other strategic priorities. One concern you often hear is, well, you know, if the United States abandons its kind of external hegemonic role, then China will sweep in to fill the vacuum. And as you mentioned in the book, China does have major interests in the region. I think that region, you write, provided China with 50% of its total oil imports since 2000. So what does China's approach to this region actually look like now? And where do you suppose it might be headed?
Yeah, so China's interest in the Middle East, like America's interest or before us, the British interest, related in many ways to resources and to access to hydrocarbons, to oil and gas. And so this is no surprise that as the United States has been less reliant upon Middle Eastern energy, and the Chinese have had almost unceasing demand for that they would supplant us as a buyer, you know, from many of these markets, and that their interests would grow not only in that way, but also because China is a major manufacturer and seller of retail goods and other goods, that they would become increasingly important to these states as a trade partner across the board, and now even in some cases more significantly as a partner for investment, as countries like Saudi Arabia are looking to diversify their economic portfolio, and they're looking for other external partners to build out their investments in areas beyond energy to diversify so that they're not entirely reliant on that side of the house. They look to China. And so China is there and eager to be a part of that. Now, the United States is shifting, rebalancing, pivoting to Asia, away from the Middle East. This does clear some field for China in important ways. But I think we have to be careful about what that actually means. I mean, first of all, we shouldn't assume that China is eager to jump in a imperial project of the 19th or 20th century. It can buy what it needs, sell what it wants, have a degree of influence without playing precisely those sorts of games. So we're seeing that. I think we also need to be careful to recognize that some of the choices that we have made over years about siding with one side or the other, the Gulf Arabs versus Iran or Israel versus Iran, now China is not necessarily obligated to play the game in the same way that we are. And at this point in China's history, at least, and we can speculate about the future, but at this point, it's clearly leading with the economic foot first, not the military foot, which is, of course, where we have gotten very large and very involved in the Middle East. And so we're seeing definitely a sort of a very different approach, an asymmetrical approach by China. But as that persists, I think we have to anticipate that with economic influence comes political influence, and with political and economic influence comes a certain investment that may, in fact, be followed by a security presence. So we have to be careful and watch to see how that develops and how China plays that game over time.
As you mentioned, even if China doesn't start to play the kind of role that America has played in that region, it still might be the case that the United States needs to adjust given China's increasing influence. And you talk a little bit about how China's approach to Iran can sometimes make U.S. priorities or initiatives in the region harder. Talk about that dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, we're seeing that in some interesting ways just over the past few weeks. You've got the recently signed strategic partnership, 25-year cooperation deal between China and Iran that got a fair amount of attention. And a number of commentators have wondered just how this was likely to affect the United States and our efforts to place pressure on Iran. And in some ways, I worry about this as well. It's clear that, you know, as the U.S.-China relationship has deteriorated, China seems more willing to press the envelope with the United States, to test our limits, and to do things like to ramp up its purchases outside of the U.S. sanctions regime, its purchases of oil from Iran. That alleviates some of the coercive pressure, certainly that the Trump administration first placed on Iran, and now the Biden administration has kept in place. As it's sought to go back to negotiations. And so by alleviating some of that pressure on Iran, you might imagine that Iran would be sort of less tempted or less likely to go back into the JCPOA, that'll make the Biden administration's life harder to renegotiate. And some of that may well be true. At the same time, I think it's worth recognizing what Iran's motives are in all of this. And it seems to me worth recalling that it's not just a matter of Iran being pressured by the United States and now China is giving it an alternative, but Iran has clearly also sought an opening, not just to U.S. markets and not primarily to U.S. markets or to access U.S. banks or anything like that, but to Europe, and has continued to perceive that economic involvement with the Europeans is more valuable to Iran, and more precious to Iran, more appealing than its relations with China. And that seems to be drawing Iran back to the nuclear negotiating table. Plus, the Europeans are quite eager to get back to business themselves. So the key there is to appreciate not just what China is up to, or even what China and the United States are doing in terms of a global geopolitical competition, but always to look also at what these lesser or less powerful states themselves want from the United States and China and how they think they can best achieve it. That'll tell you a lot about what's really going on. And I would add that's a big part of the logic of my book overall, is to always look and see what these third countries are after, see how they're going to try to use China to serve their own advantages, to advance their agendas both domestically and regionally. That's got to be a big part of our calculations.
Well, I want to ask next about South Asia, particularly this complicated nexus of the India-Pakistan rivalry and the ways that U.S. and Chinese approaches play off this dynamic. The U.S. has a long and rocky relationship with Pakistan. China has a long relationship with Pakistan as well as a deep sea port in Gwadar. Meanwhile, the United States is trying to leverage a relationship with India in order to check Chinese ambitions. So help us unpack this.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. And part of what I try to do to make a pretty complicated and dynamic story a little bit more readily digestible, but also to give it some analytical layering, is I try to break down the story of China's involvement in South Asia into kind of a two-level analysis. First, to really get a handle on what China is doing in Pakistan and how that's likely to play out for Pakistan itself. And then getting into some of the areas where I think you were emphasizing, to look at the regional dynamic and to think about how China's support to Pakistan, which we're seeing in new and really actually unprecedented ways, especially in the economic realm in terms of investments inside of Pakistan. You mentioned Gwadar Port, infrastructure across the board, to the tune of tens of billions of dollars, which for Pakistan is a big deal. So the question is, how greater Chinese involvement in these ways is affecting Pakistan's relations with India? And since it's at least a three-way game, how India is perceiving China's involvement in Pakistan, how Pakistan is perceiving China's involvement in Pakistan and its relations with India, and how China and India are themselves managing their relations, which, as we saw over the past year, can be quite contentious too. So each of these plays one into the other. And I should mention that, I really got my start thinking about China's role in this region by thinking about a four-way dynamic, which included the United States. And how the U.S.-China competition globally was likely to affect South Asia in particular. When you try to add the pieces up, of course, there's a great deal of kind of crystal ball gazing and looking forward into things that we don't know, but there are a few things that do jump out. China's greater involvement in Pakistan has the potential to embolden Pakistan, to make it feel like it has the backing of a major regional power in its dealings with its larger neighbor, India, which have long, basically always been hostile. And so that has the potential to make Pakistan more willing to take risks in its dealings with India. At the same time, India seeing that and also being more and more concerned about China's direct involvement in India's neighborhood, or what India perceives as its zone of hegemony in South Asia across the subcontinent, is increasingly nervous about China and about the China-Pakistan nexus. And so I fear and perceive that it's more likely that this is that China's greater involvement in Pakistan is destabilizing for the region, that it made India's wariness and skepticism, concerns about what's going on, plus Pakistan's potential for emboldenment with China's backing, plus China's own greater ambitions, will lead to a spiral of greater conflict between those three actors than even what we've seen over prior decades. And the past couple of years have been instances of this. India and Pakistan gone toe-to-toe, a level of violence, a level of tit-for-tat exchange, airstrikes inside of Pakistan that we really hadn't seen in quite some time. And now, perhaps even more worrisome, a breakdown in a kind of a pattern of nonviolent management of border tensions between India and China that's really got me worried about where that relationship is likely to go moving forward. So all in all, not a happy story, not a good news story about China's involvement in the region, but more worrisome.
If your assessment is right, that this is likely to be destabilizing overall, what makes sense for the United States in its approach to South Asia, in its approach to India and Pakistan here?
Well, there's not a simple answer to that, unfortunately, either, because a big part of what we would like to see from India, and what now several U.S. presidents have been working to see from India, is an emerging strategic partnership that would encourage India itself to be to continue to be a rising power and a partner, a strategic partner in this Indo-Pacific region as the United States is grappling with the geopolitical challenge posed by China. But if we overinvest in the India relationship in certain ways, we do run the risk of heightening the uncertainty and the instability that South Asia already faces, as I've already just described, of playing into dynamics that are already looking a little bit dicey, of creating a higher probability of direct India-China conflict, of India-Pakistan conflict, of conflicts that would suck the United States in as increasingly as a partner to India. And so there's a real balancing act that we have to contemplate here. We can't see this as a simple, you know, as much of a fan of seeing India as a partner as I may be, it's not so simple as bolstering India being an unalloyed good. We have to be careful about the potential knock-on effects that could have in its relations with Pakistan and China in ways that may bring about or worsen crises in the relative near term. So as I look, for instance, at the past year of India-China conflict along their land border, there are ways that we can help India that I think are not destabilizing. That is, helping India improve its capacity to see what China is up to along their border, to anticipate that, to better defend against what I perceive has been Chinese aspects of Chinese aggression, of so-called nibbling of the land border. And we can help India kind of get out ahead of those Chinese moves in ways that I think could be stabilizing. But we don't want to encourage what would conceivably be a very costly arms race along that land border that would lead both India and China to simply throw more force along that border and then increase the stakes and the risks that each runs when they come into conflict, as they're likely to do, as their patrols will come into conflict. So we have to find ways to kind of relatively inexpensively help India defend, maybe even deter against Chinese aggression without increasing the risks and the stakes at the same time.
One of the more valuable parts of your book, I think, is where you talk about Central Asia. And I think this tends to be a region that is undervalued in the DC foreign policy analytical community. So China pursues a number of interests here. You talk a lot about its approach to Kazakhstan. But it's also the case that it's an area where Russia and China both compete and cooperate. So explain what China is up to in this region and why it matters for informing U.S. strategy.
Yeah, the one thing where I would start is by saying Central Asia matters to the United States, but not all places that matter equally. And Central Asia is very far from the United States. And as I try to explain in the book, if we're thinking about prioritizing regions, it's not wrong for most policymakers in the D.C. area to put a lesser priority on a place that is generally landlocked and very distant. I don't have a problem with that. I think it would be only in the fullness of time that the strategic significance of Central Asia might be realized by a more dominant China in ways that could make it able to better compete against the United States globally. But at the moment, this is a region where Russia and China are the dominant players, and that's likely to continue to be the case for some time. And the only question is how Russia, or the central question that I'm interested in, is how Russia is or is not likely to respond to China's increasing first economic, as I've said, and then also now more political and potentially security engagement with countries like Kazakhstan that have, at least for hundreds of years, been a part of the extended Russian imperial orbit. And so the question there is, you know, right now Russia is nearly entirely fixated on its competition with the United States, with the West, its hostility toward the United States, and particularly Vladimir Putin's hostility toward Washington, D.C., but it's a broader kind of obsession. And at the same time as it's obsessed with us, it has, it seems, zero capacity or bandwidth to contemplate the implications, the strategic implications to Russia of China's increasing involvement in Central Asia. And that leads me to wonder whether Russia will wake up to the threat posed by China to its interests in this region, or whether it will continue in a way to sleepwalk on the China front because it is, as I said, fixated or even obsessed with its Western front. Right now, that seems like a genuine concern. and at the moment, Russia and China are trying to make the most of their partnership, which I think is one of convenience generally, directed toward us because it's more a matter of pushing back against the United States, against the West, than it is a matter of shared interests or affinities between the two of them. And so that seems to be the trajectory that they're on. I don't think it can hold forever. And so as it begins to unravel, that will then present questions in Moscow. Who lost Central Asia? Why and how?
Presumably, this situation will present questions in D.C. as well. Of course, back in the Cold War, it was thought to be strategically savvy to take advantage of the cleavages between Moscow and Beijing and to befriend the latter in order to avoid a, you know, a kind of undifferentiated hard line towards the communist powers. That might push them together strategically. Some people suggest today that properly triangulating these relationships is strategically wise. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, it would be nice, I suppose, in a hypothetical sense, if we could throw a wrench into the works between Russia and China, somehow sweep in and befriend Russia to deprive China of that strategic partner. The problem is that at the moment, that seems entirely unlikely. There's almost nothing we can do to, and it could be positively counterproductive to really try to wean a Vladimir Putin-dominated Russia away from China in ways that would force us into concessions with Russia on other fronts. So it's very difficult to see how, you know, that wrench can really be thrown in a way that looks like that Cold War maneuver you're describing of kind of playing the China card and play the Russia card now. Tough to see, but narrowly, what I could imagine is simply reinforcing, not just with Russia, but with lots of other countries around the world as well, our observations about the implications of their dealings with China. So it's not so much as a matter of growing closer to Russia, but exploiting possible Russian concerns, as I've identified them, with China's greater influence in its backyard. Sort of simply pointing them out, clarifying that while Russia has repeatedly, for instance, described its being very comfortable with a division of labor with China in Central Asia, where Russia continues to be the security provider, China is the dominant economic player, to observe where that may be breaking down and where China is also taking a more active security role as a means to simply reinforce some of the natural tendencies toward competition and potential friction between the two of them. And then also, over time, to keep open the door in a, say, post-Putin Russian scenario, where we can begin to discuss things in a less hostile way. And some of the things that we'll want to discuss are our mutual concerns about what China is up to in Central Asia and elsewhere. So in the fullness of time, yes, but in the near term, very, very difficult to see where we have a lot of latitude or opportunity with Russia.
Towards the end of your book, you lay out a number of different strategic options for the United States approach to China, and I want to actually explore each one. So the first one you talk about is strategic withdrawal, and it has a variant that you call strong point defense, I think, taking from Kennan. So talk to us about that option.
Yeah, so one of the questions I often get, particularly as someone who's, as in the past, I've focused a lot on Pakistan, one of the questions I often get from American foreign policy makers and observers is, you know, so the Chinese are more involved in Pakistan. This does not sound like a problem. This sounds like almost a gift to have the Chinese invested in a messy and difficult place like Pakistan, where we had so little success over the years. And then take a similar story and broaden that out to Iran, really to much of continental Eurasia. And then they say, so this is really not a problem for the United States to back off this area and to effectively cede it in a strategic sense to Chinese influence. What's the downside to that? And I think the reason why I tried to explore this option of sort of a strategic withdrawal or pulling back to points where we really do have clearer interests and influence, say in Western Europe with our allies there, or in East Asia with our treaty allies there, is because it's actually a serious position. Certainly for the near term, our resources and our influence in this neck of the woods, this part of the world, are far less certainly than we would like them to be, or we might imagine them to be. And China's influence is growing. So there is a certain realism to that approach that I find compelling and attractive, as other people, including officials I consulted within the government, within the U.S. government, observed. There are some natural, they describe them as antibodies to Chinese influence in Eurasia, including Muslim majority populations in a number of the countries, who will naturally have some qualms, at least, with closer ties with an enormous communist, anti-Muslim country. And so that's not going to be an easy relationship for China to manage. So let it attempt to do so, and we'll pull back. Now, the one downside to all of this logic, and that I try to explain in the book, is, you know, in the near term, I'm less concerned about it, but over time, we also have to anticipate that as China's capacity for extending its influence in these areas grows, its capacity for projecting power across them, military power even across them, will grow. And that does not necessarily mean it will bring with it peace or stability or harmony or even dominant control over these regions. What you could get is conceivably a much messier, more divided, more violent, and dangerous part of the world, with simultaneously greater penetration by Chinese power. And that doesn't look very pretty. So, you know, there is a question of sort of completely ceding this ground to Chinese influence, may be appealing and attractive in the near term, and may have come with some costs over the longer term. I simply wouldn't want to leave people too rosy-eyed with the prospect of, you know, what will come of a more Chinese-dominated continental Eurasia. It doesn't mean peace, development, win-win, harmony in quite the way, I think, that the Chinese sometimes sketch it out to be. It could be a much uglier scenario than that. And I think we need to be alive to that possibility, at least.
You also explore something called peaceful accommodation. What might that look like?
Yeah, look, there are a number of more middle ground areas where our response to China, say to the Belt and Road Initiative, need not be so critical. A number of observers have said, you know, as there are a number of areas where China is attempting to do things like build roads or power plants or rail lines or pipelines that may actually serve to benefit people in the region and the broader regional economy, to encourage the types of regional economic integration that, in fact, the United States, Japan, the Europeans, really everyone has attempted to encourage now for decades in this part of the world. And so maybe there are areas where not only can we stand aside and allow the Chinese to continue on with these activities, but we may be even able to find opportunities for partnership with the Chinese, or at least to harmonize our own development agenda, our own assistance agenda in some of these countries, or our agenda through multilateral bodies, whether it's the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank, or working with other partners like Japan, in ways that would complement activities that the Chinese are undertaking and actually maybe produce significantly better outcomes on the ground. So a specific example, say in Pakistan, would be where the Chinese may be building a power plant, but haven't invested in the technology to improve the electrical grid that that power plant is connected to, or haven't invested in the training of the individuals, the engineers, and the operators who would actually manage either the plant or the electrical grid. Maybe those are areas where we and others in the international community can step in and actually assist and turn partway Chinese investments and possibly investments that would end up being ineffective into more effective and more successful investments that actually serve our and China's strategic agenda in some important cases like Pakistan or Kazakhstan or some of the other cases that I look at.
Critical publicity. I think the Biden administration might be engaging in some of this.
Absolutely. And so was the Trump administration before it. And I have sympathy for this option as well. But the basic notion is that China is up to a variety of different things. And it's important that we and others shed a light on the pros, and especially given that we're in a competition with China, the cons of what China is doing. Now, some of this, I think, can be a little bit misplaced. I think for an example of that would be a kind of a tendency toward the overemphasis of the so-called debt trap diplomacy that the Chinese have been up to in a number of cases, but Sri Lanka is the poster child for this. I think we sometimes come across as providing too simple analysis, too critical in ways that really don't appeal to the target audience, in this case, that don't make Sri Lankans more inclined to be critical of China or more likely to work with us, but simply to see us as kind of troublemakers, as unhelpful outside players. So part of the challenge is how can you be critical, but also constructively critical in ways that win over audiences in other countries, convincing them not only that maybe what China is doing is not as good as it looks and comes with unforeseen downsides, but that there are actual realistic alternatives to help these countries solve the problems that they face. That's the best version of a critical publicity strategy. And sometimes we get closer to that. One of the approaches that I've heard about, which has yet to be fully implemented, is this idea of a so-called blue dot network for identifying and effectively branding high-quality infrastructure investment projects in Asia. And the notion here was that if a project was actually seen as smart as an investment, a sound, sustainable investment, one that didn't come with enormous costs, either economically or environmentally or in terms of labor exploitation and so on, then they would probably qualify for a blue dot designation, which would mean that they were considered good by a broader number of states, not just the United States, but Japan and Australia and others. This seems like a smart move. If we could actually get our act together and figure out how to identify a blue dot network project from a non-blue dot network project, then maybe we could really show other countries that we're invested in helping them identify better projects and separating them from potentially counterproductive ones. And that would lead over time, if successful, to these countries making better informed decisions about which things they actually invest their own resources in, which types of projects they go into with China or with anyone else for that matter. That's a smart approach to critical publicity. A last observation would be on this is that I've talked to, for instance, a number of Pakistanis who see China's investment in Pakistan as something that they don't really have alternatives. No one else is investing in Pakistan, including the United States. And so who are they to say no to Chinese investments? And in particular, as I talk to them more, they have, I think, some qualms increasingly about investments in their telecommunications infrastructure, which would enable not just China, but also their own government to be engaged in more repressive political actions against opposition figures, or really against anyone who opposes the state. And that's something that I think makes a lot of Pakistanis nervous. And that's the sort of thing that I think the United States should be clear about in its public messaging. And so that would fall into the critical publicity side of things as well.
The tricky part with this approach, I think, revealed itself in the clash between Secretary of State Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and their Chinese counterparts a few weeks ago. It would behoove us to be careful not to wave our finger at China for doing things that we do as a matter of routine. And you know, the worry and concern about China enabling dictatorships around the world is one of those things that America can't really point its finger about, because we do that as a matter of routine. The last two I'll conjoin: selective competition and militarized competition. What are these like?
So, no, you make a really good point about the challenges that the United States currently faces, especially the Biden administration faces, in talking to the world about enabling democracy. We have our own problems at home that are quite obvious, but also, we don't have a spotless record with other countries. And I certainly get this from Pakistani friends who will say, hey, look, at the historical record suggests the United States has been more than happy to work with Pakistan's military dictators over many years. China may be no different. My only qualm with accepting that fully is that there are many in the United States, including not just in the Biden administration, but elsewhere, who have always been deeply uncomfortable working with Pakistan's military dictators and are more comfortable working with democracies. Does that mean that they have always prioritized democracy? Certainly not. But in their very hypocrisy and their discomfort, that I think that still separates us from Beijing in some important ways. So I don't want to overemphasize that or dismiss criticisms of the U.S. for, you know, for suggesting that we can do more, or have done more to support democracy in the world than we have. But to say that there still is an important difference for friends around the world who are opposition figures or independent journalists, I would like them to at least at times believe that they have friends and supporters, even champions inside the United States, in ways that they'll never find in China. And that's a distinction that I think is still relevant.
So I'll join up these last two. Talk about selective competition and militarized competition.
Yeah, so look, I think selective competition is picking and choosing our battles with the Chinese in places like, so looking at continental Eurasia. Where are we going to find that we can actually outdo China, not at its own games, but in a kind of a asymmetrical approach to dealing with Chinese actions? So a minor example of this would be in a place like Kazakhstan. It makes no sense for us to attempt to try to compete with China in the pure physical infrastructure development game. They've got that more or less locked up. But there are other ways that we can compete with China, say on science and technology or higher education in terms of exchanges and things like that, or even direct investment and partnership on the economic front, where we have something to offer that China may not. And that's where we need to selectively identify where it matters to compete. In the case of Kazakhstan, in itself, not terribly geopolitically important for the United States, but because China is increasingly involved there, maybe it makes sense for the United States to be just marginally more involved as a means to provide Kazakhstan's leadership with alternatives that they are desperate to find, so that they do not become say, solely owned subsidiaries of China Inc., that they can actually play China against Russia, against the United States, which preserves a degree of autonomy, of sovereignty, which is something that they clearly value, and which actually plays to our interests as well. So how can we selectively identify those instances where it makes sense, either to play a marginal role, like I've just described there, or maybe a more significant role, as I've already tried to describe in the case of India, which is, I think, likely to be an important partner in South Asia, and how to contemplate that competition, that geopolitical competition with China, as we consider other regional dynamics, like the Iran problem, Iran's nuclear weapons, and so on. So that's selective competition. And then the last, the more extreme approach, is to think about the military implications of all of this, and to consider, if not in the near term, perhaps over the coming decades, what it would mean to have a China that is more militarily involved, possibly even more dominant as a military player and security provider across an enormous swath of territory that leads all the way overland to the Persian Gulf, even to the Mediterranean or near to the Mediterranean, what that would mean for the United States in military terms. Because if we have, as suggested by sort of a more selective approach or even a standoff approach to the region, if we have maintained close ties with our allies in Western Europe and East Asia, as China continues to grow, that power and military projection capability will eventually reach their doorstep. So we'll have to contemplate what that means and perhaps prepare for that and think about that preparation in a long-term way, not something that needs to happen overnight, or we need to be concerned about every Chinese move, say a base in Djibouti or investments at Gwadar, but how the sum total of that would be likely to reshape China's footprint globally, and what that would mean for us militarily. So that's that option, and I think that long-term approach is one that's warranted as well.
Now that we've very thoroughly explored the options, how do you assess the Biden administration's approach so far to China, and where do you think it ought to go?
Look, I think at the moment they've played a game which reflects concerns about tactics and dealing with China diplomatically, and lessons learned, I think they believe, from the early Obama administration, that reflect both domestic political lessons, that is how the American body politic responds, and tactical lessons about how to make sure that you don't lose points in your dealings with China right out of the gate. And they believe very clearly that taking a tough approach toward China, an unapologetic approach, one that is quite critical, is likely not just to you know, keep Beijing up at night or something like that, but does not cede any ground or suggest weakness that China, they believe, that Beijing would just capitalize or pocket right out of the gate and try to take advantage of over the next 4 years. So I see in their latest, or their opening salvo, something more along the line of tactics that plays into a broader strategy, which I think will be an organizing principle of this administration, which is competition with China is going to affect every aspect of what the United States is doing around the world in big and small ways. And the Trump administration took a pretty, I would say, undifferentiated approach to this, a not terribly subtle approach to this. The Biden administration sees the threat in ways that are actually fairly similar, but is likely to try to prioritize, particularly, and this is the critical differentiator, particularly in its dealings with friends and allies. That is, the key to the strategy for the Biden administration for competing with China is trying to come with a lot of friends to the table and not alienating regional players, including NATO partners or Canada or Japan or Korea, but bringing them along and in effect trying to group China or to make China feel like it's the odd man out, as compared to the Trump administration, which effectively went its own way, took the competition, the bilateral with competition with China, up to a new level, but didn't bring its friends along as it did so.
Daniel Marquis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.